You may have caught the footage from the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, Ohio this week. Republican nominee Donald Trump's wife, Melania, gave a speech that appeared to borrow heavily from the convention speech of Michelle Obama just 4 years ago. My favourite defence, there were many defences mounted against accusations of plagiarism, but my favourite defence came from a Texan Republican delegate who said, "There's only so many ways to say so many things. Every time I say hello, am I plagiarising?" There's a deep philosophical question right there. The fight to protect intellectual property is a wide-reaching one, and as we've discussed previously on this show, it's an area that can be particularly fraught in the world of design. Next month, the Productivity Commission is due to hand down a report into intellectual property in Australia, and our next guests, designer David Troubridge and Anne-Marie Sargent, who heads an organisation called the Authentic Design Alliance, will be watching the developments closely. Now, if you're a particularly astute listener to Blueprint for Living, you will remember an interview we did with David back in early 2015. At the time, he was having quite a few issues with what he felt were copies of his well-known woodcut lights being sold here. Before we speak with David and Anne-Marie about what's happened since we last spoke, let's hear a little about how he first came up with the idea for one of his signature lights.
The design was actually developed in Perth in 2003. And at the time I was a furniture designer, I'd done no lighting. And I was playing with form and structure and created this thing, which I thought, well, that's quite pretty, but what do I do with it? And I stuck a light bulb in it and maybe that'll sell, and it did. And so it became a very popular piece. And through that, I discovered that there was this kind of niche in the world market for patterned, decorative, often wooden light shades, which rely a lot on the emotional shadow effects that they create.
David Troubridge, welcome back to Blueprint for Living.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Now, you've had some success since we last spoke, which is a nice way to catch up. Some of the replicas of this particular light are now off the shelves in Australia. Can you tell us what happened?
Actually, most of them are, and it's a really good success story. And I actually have to say it's partly thanks to you guys, because after that radio interview, when I was explaining how that coral light came about, K&L Gates solicitors came on and said, "We think we can help you," because they understood that I designed that light as an act of artistic craftsmanship. I'm not really a product designer. I spent most of my life designing and making furniture myself as a craftsman. And this was a continuation of that. So it came out of an act of art craft. And they said that puts under slightly different rules, which is great for me, but unfortunately it doesn't really help the bigger picture of intellectual property in Australia.
Right, so it's more in the nature of a loophole than it is about a challenge to the ideas about design and IP.
That's correct, yes. It's a sort of one-off case in a way, because most people who are practicing as designers in Australia are industrial designers who are creating products, so they come under a different ruling.
Right, so how many importers agreed to stop selling the copies?
Six or seven.
That's a great result. And so what happens to the stock in that kind of case? Do they have to destroy it all? Is that?
Yep, they do.
You don't look heartbroken by that. I'm going to be clear to listeners.
Actually, I do. I mean, we had an event with Anne-Marie in Sydney just a few weeks ago. And some of the stock, which had to be destroyed, we said we would destroy them. And we did it at a sort of public event at a design show in Sydney. And it was kind of making the point, and we took some videos and photographs of it. But it's still kind of... I'm not comfortable with that. It's just waste of materials, and I don't like breaking anything up. Even if it's a fake, it's a copy, it still doesn't really feel good.
Yeah, no, it's a tricky thing. Anne-Marie Sargent, tell us a little bit about the Authentic Design Alliance. What's your group trying to achieve?
We've got several aims, but the primary aim is to try and introduce similar laws that Europe has had for a long time, and the UK has just legislated now, that is making illegal and replica designs. They've criminalised it. So the UK originally, the scenario in the UK, they had introduced laws that were intended to be in place in 2020, i.e. in 4 years' time. But over the course of the campaigning, it was deemed that it was such a so damaging to the creative industries that the laws were brought forward by 4 years and they're now in place. And on February the 14th, it was announced that fines of up to £50,000 and up to 10 years jail apply for the supply or distribution of fake designer furniture. Not only that, they went a step further in protecting the rights of the British designers in line with the EU. So that means if you're an industrial designer and you create a product, you have 2 years to test that product group before you need to design register it. And then the length of protection extends beyond the lifetime of the creator for another 70 years. in Australia, we have a poultry 5 years plus 5 years, and we have a very complicated system. And it's
Sorry, before you go on, just explain that 5 years plus five years.
So a designer, if a designer wants to protect their work in Australia presently, they must design register it immediately prior to it entering the public domain. It can't even appear on the internet. And that registration protection period is 5 years. Then after that time, it must be renewed for another 5 years. And after 10 years, the design or the concept is available to anyone to rip off. So if you were a designer and you're 20, by the time you're 30 and you've had your one hit, when you've had your one big seller when you're 20, by the time you're 30, everyone else is able to profit from that by law if they wanted to.
And I seem to remember from last time we discussed this, and correct me if I've got it wrong, but there's something about it having to be in the marketplace before it's registered. How does that work?
No, to not be in the marketplace. Whereas
Which is unusual or atypical.
Well, historically, the design cycle, for example, for a chair is typically around 2 years. So that's where the Europeans have been working on. There's 2 years. Let's talk about musicians. I make my first album. There's 10 songs on that album and there's one hit song. I design 10 chairs. One of them gets refined after 2 years of market research, and then that gets invested into going to the tooling and the cost of production, which is vast. In Australia, there's not those opportunities that they have in Europe. The design must be, all those 10 chairs that I design, every single one of them must be registered, and then maybe one of them becomes a hit. So it's almost like a double-edged sword.
Mm. What's your band called for your album?
I don't have one.
See, I was so ready to believe in your music career, although one hit on an album of 10 is not ideal. I mean, that's disappointing. Anne-Marie, you heard David say that it had some success thanks to the protection of the kind of category of artistic creator.
Yes.
That's just not available to most designers.
No, it's not available. And because industrial design is a process. So there's two things that we're talking about here. One is makers. Self-trained makers in a way, or they've come through the crafts or come through craftsmanship. And the other angle is people that have studied industrial design. The rise of makers is so strong that there are as many makers now as there are industrial designers. So the laws need to represent fairness across the board. And basically, if somebody rips off your idea, whatever business you're in, there doesn't seem to be any sense of justice there from the consumer end of it. The consumer's just as much to blame because there's a culture here of cheap is better, and if it's broken, chuck it out and get another one. And the culture here tends to prefer to buy 10 copy chairs than one original chair, for example.
David, even though it's a happy ending, it's been a really long process for you. And as well as the importers, I remember there was a particular retailer that was selling what you felt were copies. You had success with that also after a number of letters. Is that right?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I don't want to mention names, but no. I mean, some of these are big, well-known retailers. And this was even before the artistic craftsmanship issue came up, that one of those retailers we approached actually came back to, well, sorry, we shouldn't have done that, and offered good terms for settlement, which I accepted. And I thought that was a generous gesture at that point. Just kind of adding on to Anne-Marie's point about that kind of lead time, for us in the lighting industry, it's even more critical because when I started making lights, I could hang a light and sell it. Today, you've got to get it certified. And the more complex the light, the more complex and expensive the certification. And that process alone can take 6 months. Even after you've developed your design, you then got to send it off and it might come back needing changes. It might cost you $10,000, $20,000 to certify a light.
Yeah.
And so if you've only got 10 years to recoup that cost and you've already spent two or three of those already,
it doesn't encourage individual designers to off their own back, off their own kind of buck.
It encourages Australian designers to work offshore. So if this continues, then there's an inevitable talent drain that will happen. So one of the designers I work closely with, Christopher Boots, is also a lighting designer. He's evolved America as his biggest market because it's easier for him to expand in America than it is to pursue in Australia when there are products that their drawings get sent to an architect, puts the drawing in the project, then the business development manager or the project manager decides that he might be able to save a lot of money by taking those drawings and having them made up at another workshop.
You're listening to Blueprint for Living on RN. I'm talking with David Troubridge and Anne-Marie Sargent about the nature of intellectual property in the design world in Australia. Anne-Marie, we mentioned that the Productivity Commission is due to report on IP next month. A draft report's already been released. What kinds of clues are you getting about what's going to come out? What kind of feedback is coming
out? Look, it's a very long and complex process. I mean, the draft report itself is a 600-page document, and it's very dense, and it covers many different sectors, not just the design industry. So there's the pharmaceutical industry, there's publishing. Within the design sector, there didn't seem to be an understanding of the needs of designers, as David was saying. We came from a different angle. Since they wrote the report, we said, look at the UK. They've just changed the laws. Why can't we just adopt the UK? I mean, yes, the report exists. Yes, a lot of work's gone into it. But here we have a blueprint, no pun intended, but we have a blueprint in the UK that we can pick up and follow the model.
Is it because, I mean, often Productivity Commission reports are as concerned about the impact on consumers as they are on creators. How much of it is about the kind of rise of the replica retailer and the consumers who want cheap products?
This was the alarming thing. This was the alarming thing. There was a word that came out very late in my dealings with Canberra, which have been extensive, called substitutability. Ooh. Now, as a professional writer...
That offends me as a word, apart from the meaning.
As a professional writer, I had to stop. It took me 3 days to learn how to say it, but I had to stop and say, excuse me, I'm sorry, I don't understand the word substitutability. Now, I'm guessing it probably came from the pharmaceutical industry where you can have a substitute product, but there seems to be a general, and I'm assuming there seems to be a general feeling that the consumer has a right to a substitute chair. Now, we were arguing, why does it have to be a copy? There's plenty of chairs. It doesn't have to be a copy.
So are consumer rights at odds with designer rights inevitably, do you think? I mean, are we so conditioned to expect cheaper things, more convenient things? Does that fly in the face of good design principles?
It does, and I think there's one step further going back to your last question where there seems to be an overriding expectation within the productivity report to try and protect the replica industry because they see that in itself as an industry as opposed to looking at our own creative industries. And everybody talks about innovation.
Why can't the industry, which is selling cheap chairs, I mean, if people want cheap chairs, they get their own designers to create their own cheap chairs and they sell them. They don't have to copy our designs to do that. And this is the issue. This is the problem.
We'll be watching what happens closely. Thank you both so much for your time. I've been speaking with designer David Troubridge and from the Authentic Design Alliance, Anne-Marie Sargent. For links to information about the Productivity Commission process and the Authentic Design Alliance, you can go to the Blueprint for Living part of the RN website, and there's also a link to that earlier interview with David in less happy times. And if you're the proud owner of some dubious off-brand replicas or knockoffs, let us know on the Facebook page.